Mike Day has coached Bodie Miller, the winningest American male skier of all time. He was Ted Ligety's coach when Ted had those crazy victory margins and the triple gold medal at World Champs. And he was Michaela Schifrin's coach for 65 of her World Cup victories. Small side note on that. As she is still racing, Mike opted to not talk about Michaela specifically in this interview. Regardless, this episode could have been a five-part docu-series at ESPN 30 for 30 with everything Mike knows and has done over the years. But I stuck to our typical hour-long episode, and Mike still managed to pack this thing full of wisdom and good stories. You might even need to listen to it a couple times to fully absorb it all. All right, I'm done selling. Let's do this thing. And we are back. I'm Jimmy Krupka, and welcome to Arc City. Arc City is officially sponsored by Ski Racing Media. This episode is sponsored by On Location. I'd also like to thank Sync Performance for supporting me this season, and a shout out to Ski Cosmos, a ski simulator and training center in Vancouver. Learn more at skicosmos.com. Mike Day is currently the Alpine Program Director and Assistant Head of School at the Green Mountain Valley School, GMVS, in Waitsfield, Vermont. Now, without further ado, Mike Day. Mike Day, welcome to Arc City.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. It's been a few years since we've been trying to get this done.
Yeah, I know. We were just talking about that before the call. I think I talked to you about having you on right when I started this podcast. So I'm psyched to have you. For those who don't know, Mike coached me from like 2014 to 2016. I think my last 2 years of high school, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And I was probably the fastest skier you ever coached.
One of my greatest success stories for sure. You and my wife, who I did some drills with this morning. So,
oh really?
No, you were a tremendous skier. And you know, I would argue that GS though was probably your best event at that point in time.
Yeah, it's funny now looking back at it. Yeah. Maybe I still have it in me. I mean, I haven't stopped skiing GS. But anyway, the reason we're here is not to talk about me, but the people you coached who won World Cups. And I have a million questions for you, but we'll get through some of them. So I have this right. You started coaching at CVA when you were pretty young, right? Like right out of college?
Yeah, after a short stint in finance and staring at computer screens, I landed in a coaching job at CVA, yes.
Oh, so that was the motivation to be a ski coach.
Yeah, I couldn't stand the idea of making so much money in finance. So I wanted hardship in my life. And I did think for sure through college and so forth, that was the route I was going to go. And I gave it a shot and didn't love being indoors all day and staring at computer screens. And ultimately, I went to CVA and graduated from CVA as well. And I just had an opportunity to go back and start assistant coaching in the middle of the winter. Somebody had stepped away and they needed help, and I jumped up there, and that's how it started.
So that was like 30 years ago, right? Sorry, I'm not trying to date you here. Yeah.
You're totally dating me. Mid-90s, early 90s. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And then you were coaching Bodie there, right?
Yeah, unfortunately for me, I just walked into a group with Chip Cochran, legendary coach from up there, American downhiller, one of the OGs. Bodie was a 17-year-old kid, skinny, tall dude from Franconia that was skiing like a madman, basically. I didn't understand what he was doing much on skis, but he fully understood it. And fortunately for me as well, I didn't know anything really about coaching and much about technique either. So it was pretty good group of mentors up there with staff, and obviously fun to learn from Bodie as well.
Yeah, what was that like? Seeing that young Bodie I mean, now you've got the hindsight of everything that he's done, but in that moment, watching 17-year-old Bodie do what he did on the training course and in the race hill, first of all, what was he doing? And second, what was did you believe that he was ever going to make it?
At that point in time, you know, I think some of the chaotic upper body and just gangliness of his skiing that you saw even sometimes when he was at his best and sort of wild man type of stuff was definitely there. The skis and equipment were way different. So, I mean, he was still on long GS skis, you know, 205 centimeter GS skis without any side cut, and slalom skis at that point were, you know, 195 centimeters or something. So, you know, he was essentially stuck to this technique and approach that was intriguing, I would say. I don't think it was super effective. He was, you know, not dominating by any means until he was competitive. But, you know, when the ski change and technology change to parabolic skis and that K24 was kind of the start of all that, and he was the one that jumped onto that ski and really took off with skiing that was honestly very similar to what he was doing previously. It just the magic was, you know, putting that athleticism and approach together with the right materials, and suddenly he took off. So early on, though, again, I mean, I was pretty comfortable with the fact that I didn't really know ski racing or technique or approach, so I wouldn't have honestly known if he was if he was gonna make it, not make it, you know, exactly what that skiing was that he was doing. I joke with some people, one of the very first days I saw him, there's a trail at Sugarloaf called Skitter, and we were training slalom on the edge of the trail with no fence, because we didn't use fence at that point. And he flew out of the course and basically off the trail. And I was up at the top and kind of thought to myself, like, he just flew straight into the woods. And literally like a second later, he came flying back out of the woods at the same speed he went into the woods and got right back into the course, like one gate later, sort of thing. So that was kind of my intro to his antics and just his unique approach.
Yeah, that's a great story. Did he switch to the K24s, those new parabolic skis? Did he switch to those while he was at CVA?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've heard a lot of stories about that. Was it his idea, or did someone already kind of figure it out, or how did that process go?
I think he would have to answer that exactly. I don't know the answer. K2 was obviously a forerunner in race. Like, they were tremendous in the race world, and from a R&D standpoint, were you know, the American company that was willing to take some chances. And there was a guy, George Torme, actually from Stowe, that ran the K2 race department and lived right here. And he was an incredible guy and somebody, I think, with a big open vision to think like, hey, maybe these could work. And, you know, I don't know if you remember, they had a little brain on them, like this little light that lit up this raised area right in front of the toe piece of the binding. And to be able to get a plate on there, you had to cut the very front edge of the plate off, like with a hacksaw. So it didn't interfere with the brain, so to say. So they weren't made for racing, clearly, at that point, but they immediately took off. And I don't know whose idea it was. I just know when he got his first pair that he didn't even think twice about ever really going back. I mean, you've heard the stories of him racing Super G on these 198 K24s for junior nationals, and he won the Super G at Sugarloaf on a pair of those skis, as well as the GS, and never figured on the short shape slalom ski. That didn't come for a little while still, but it was pretty crazy to see how that all matched up and worked out. And I mean, with a single pair of skis, I remember going to a couple NORAM races and he didn't have a second pair of skis. Like, they didn't have enough of them. So there wasn't even a training ski, basically, and we would go to a NorAm race with a single pair of skis and do the warm up and whatever else, or a little bit of warm up, and then go out and race on the one pair for both runs. So kind of crazy, crazy stuff.
That's great. That reminds me, we may take a slight detour here and then we'll get back on track, but a lot on in this podcast I talk a lot about like accessibility and ski racing, and Bodie was someone who grew up with almost nothing. I think for a large portion of his life his family lived in the woods with no running water. Do you see a story like that? Like, is that still possible to come from nothing and just to be a kid who skis every day? And to somehow like figure out the resources to ski NorAms, make it to the US ski team.
I would say that nothing's impossible. I would say sadly that I think it's become even a bigger stretch from when he did it till today, kind of the direction the sport has gone and how exclusive it has become. So I think that, even with Bodie, he had some, he had CVA on his side. He had some donors on his side that, definitely helped along the way, to ensure that he got to the right races and was able to do the right things. And, I think it's just becoming, now that youth sports in general have become so specialized, that the specialization in skiing and want to ski, the everything out there is you need to ski more, we don't practice enough, you need more practice time, and practice time in this sport is so incredibly expensive, and especially in the off season. So I think it's getting harder and harder to imagine how people would go about doing that 25 years later, or however many years it's been. So I know that there's people out there that are really driving the health of sport, and how can we make this more accessible? And I think it's skiing, the sport of skiing, not just ski racing, is difficult to find access to. So if you can't ski, then clearly you're probably not going to be a ski racer. So I mean, I think the exclusivity just continues to get greater and greater, the more specialized you get in the sport. So I'd like to say that, I think the to a certain extent the cream rises to the top, and that if you can find a way, that might be possible, but I think the percentage chances are getting lower and lower.
That's a shame. I mean, but people, there's a lot of people out there that are making efforts to change that. So there is reason for some optimism in some places, but I would agree with you. I think that it's very difficult just to get into skiing these days.
But I also think, though, it sort of segues into how great high school racing is, and how great NASCAR racing is, and like any of these entry points to the competitive side of the sport are fantastic. So I don't think that it has to be, everybody pursuing the very highest level of the sport, whether that's, FIS racing or national championships or World Cup or, Olympics, whatever it might be. I think that there's some great options out there that get kids involved in the sport at a very low cost. So I think that all of those things, and all of those entry points are, great, great spots to look at, and exciting ways to ultimately be involved and understand the sport a little bit.
I completely agree. Well, while we have you here, and I've actually never had Bodie on the podcast, which is probably why I ask for so many Bodie stories. I asked Sasha for Bodie stories, but there's a million of them. Another thing I'm curious about him is that, I mean, you got to see him when you were on the US team, or when you were coaching for the US team, right? When he was having more success also as well.
Success at a higher level. I was very lucky to be able to join the national team prior to the Salt Lake Olympics. So I was able to watch Bodie win his first World Cups and first Olympic medals as well. So pretty spectacular experience for me.
And I heard him on an interview say once that he thought that he never really skied that much faster in races, but that everyone else skied slower, and he just knew how to put down his best training run in the race. Is that accurate, you think?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I think that's probably accurate for most of the great skiers, honestly. I mean, I think that the challenge is bringing that skiing from training into races, and the idea of bringing out a special performance, I think, is likely a bit misleading, from the perspective that you have to ski better than you ever have, whether that's skiing or swimming or soccer or whatever it might be. You're not going to go out there and I'm going to play better than I ever have played today. You're going to play as well as you can play, and normally that's as good as training, and oftentimes it's slightly worse than training, where you're more free and there's more repetition and everything else. So I think the ultimate goal would be to to perform at a similar level as your training skiing in races.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important thing for young skiers to understand. And that's always, I mean, even now it's hard for me to understand of like, you don't have to go out there and change the world with this run. You have to go out there and just put down what you've always put down in training.
And I think that, in being back with junior racing for the last couple of years, I mean, I think that race day habits and race day routines, those type of things are super important. But I think the most important piece is that they're everyday routines. I ask the question all the time with groups of younger kids. I'm like, well, do you eat a different breakfast on race day than you do on training days? Well, yeah, of course. I eat eggs. I don't eat cereal, and I'm like, okay. Do you put more effort into the tuning, of your skis for race day? Well, yeah, why wouldn't I? Like all of these things that you do differently on race day are honestly, are probably just getting in your head and getting in the way, because you want to treat every day the same and similar, and have the same routines in place off snow warm up. You have back, been dealing with a back and everything else. I mean, you ask the question like, when you go out to play a soccer match, do you just sprint out of the locker room straight onto the field and start playing, or do you actually warm up and stretch and get your body ready to go? I mean, so off snow warm up, on snow warm up, are you going to inspect in a way that's completely different than the way you inspect in training? So right away you set yourself up for all of these strange expectations that it's a different day, and the whole goal is to make it the same day.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I fully agree. And it's easier said than done, but that's something I've
For
been working
sure.
on lately. The other thing that I heard about Bodhi pertaining to this subject is that he would, in order to bring out his best run, his best training run on race day, when there's a lot of pressure, especially at Olympics or World Champs or something like that, you need to block out the distractions. You need to find a way to get motivated. And he would kind of create these like scenarios in his head. Is that something that you know about or want to talk about or?
No, I actually don't. I mean, it doesn't sound crazy to me, because I think if I said that I really knew a lot about, the inner workings of his approach and his mind, I would be lying. I mean, I think that there's, he was a guy that really was very confident in his approach, and he was polite with coaches, and definitely, was open to talking, but he had his approach that he was going to go with almost every time. It was going to be his choice online or whatever it might be. And in a lot of cases, sitting there, hearing what he wanted to do and wondering to myself, like, is that even possible? And then he would come down, and in most cases it was completely possible and actually really fast. So he would have thoughts that as a just normal trained coach for me, I would be like, well, that's actually not what I would recommend, but let's give it a shot. And oftentimes it was great. Every now and then it wasn't, but I think that's kind of the whole fun of being a fan of his and being a friend for a long period of time, just super, super enjoyable and educational along the way.
That's cool. Yeah, I've heard he was just a total student of the sport and really enjoyed learning, constantly learning about it. I've got a discount code for you for Sync Performance. And I love Sync not only because they make great products like my snow pants that have the perfect size and placement of pockets and they're waterproof and the side zippers never break. I could go on and on because Sync is improving their designs every year because they get feedback from their ski racing athletes. I literally sit on Zoom and tell them what to change. It's awesome. But also I love Sync because they have always supported independent ski racers like me. And through the Sync Athlete Fund, they help bridge the funding gap in ski racing from U16s all the way to senior racers. You can shop all the great skiing and ski racing products that Sync has to offer at syncperformance.com and use the code ARCCITY15 for 15% off your order. And then you worked with Ted as well. And what years did you work with Ted?
Well, I don't know the math very well. Well, Ted, I mean, everybody knows Ted's story a bit with regards to how quickly he rose from fairly mediocre to really good. So I was working at the Park City ski team and I left to join the US ski team. And then I went back shortly after the Salt Lake Olympics to the Park City ski team. And that's when I started working more with Ted for a year or two, I think, at the Park City ski team, and then had a similar experience. You know, 5 or 6 years later, I was able to rejoin him on the World Cup tour as well.
I mean, I'd like to call it a coincidence, but you seem to end up around these really good skiers and they end up being successful. Like, do you think there's something that you contributed as a coach, even as a young coach and inexperienced? You think there's something you contributed to their success?
I don't know. I've never been one to take credit. And oftentimes I've honestly gone quite the opposite and said, I've been really lucky in my career. And people over time have said, well, you make your own luck to a certain extent. So,
yeah.
You know, I think there's been some good fortune with timing and happenstance, so to say. And, you know, I don't think I'm teaching anything magical with my ski coaching. I think that from a coaching perspective alone, my approach has been incredibly simple. And I think you probably remember as well. I mean, I there's a handful of things for me that are super important to fast skiing and consistent skiing and repeatable skiing. And I'm just not really willing to waver from those things. And I don't think that approach is necessarily what made either of those guys great skiers. But, you know, I guess something that I'm able to bring is, you know, consistency from day to day and an environment that people tend to be good with and have some success with. So, but I don't have any magical concepts that I'm hiding from the general public. I think that some of it is good fortune and, you know, other pieces of it, I've done a good job. I don't know.
Yeah,
I
don't
know
you don't have like magical, like quartz crystals or something.
I wish I did, or that super special technical thing that nobody can actually see. It just works. So, you know, and I think that some of those basics, you know, the simplicity, the sport is so incredibly complex, right? It's fleeting. It's frustrating. It's magical. Like, it's all of those things, you know, all rolled up into one. And, you know, I think a complex sport, anytime you take a complex sport and you try to make it more difficult, or you're not trying to synthesize, I think simple is not always the right word, but synthesize the important bits down, then you're probably going the wrong way. And I think that, you know, ski racing people understand how dynamic and complicated ski racing and skiing is. Nobody else does. And I think that, you know, we talk about the great athletes in America, you know, football players, basketball players, all of these different things. And I think that, you know, if you took a basketball court and you started to move the hoop back and forth, right, while they were shooting, like, that's a step. You know, then take the court and start moving the court like this, you know, and have the hoop moving up and down and side to side. Like, you're getting closer and closer to how dynamic ski racing can be. And I think that, you know, that's really why it's such a difficult sport to capture and be super consistent and, you know, be able to bring, you know, great results on a daily, you know, weekly, monthly, and, you know, year after year kind of basis.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Hopefully someone listening who doesn't know the sport that well can use that metaphor. Yeah. Or people can use it to explain to their non-skiing friends the how dynamic it is and how many variables there are. And that's why it's so frustrating, is like, you can be skiing, you can be the best in the world skiing on a certain hill in a certain snow, and you can be 40th in the world skiing on a different hill with the same snow, or different snow, different hill. I mean, there's so many variables that change. How do you approach that with the athletes you've coached, like attacking just being fast in every condition, in every
I mean, there's not many racers out there that are good in every condition. I mean, I think it's one thing to look at the snow conditions, because we know how variable that can be, right? From injected ice to salted, salted, softer, rainy type of conditions. So you can fill that gamut in, but then, you know, you take the slope, and some slopes are, you know, far steeper and far more gnarly, so to say, than others. So you have more moderate hills, you know, and then I think light is another piece that's a big one. You know, some people perform everybody performs better in sunshine, but some people have a huge drop when it comes to flat light, or, you know, impaired visibility with fog or anything like that, or snow. So I think there's like a million different factors in there when it comes to figuring that out. I think, you know, materials alone, you know, and trying to develop materials and skis and boots that, and plates and bindings that work in all conditions, that it's almost never the case where one pair of skis or works in every single condition. So it becomes extremely, extremely technological and laborious, honestly, to figure out, you know, how to get a ski that works in salted conditions, or, you know, hosed in salted conditions versus injected. I mean, those skis are not the same at all. And, you know, some of it come, then you can talk about tunes and everything else. Mm-hmm. Though, I mean, I think that for me, when you're working with elite athletes, I mean, ultimately training becomes far more specified and situational. So, you know, you're kind of looking for those opportunities to address weaknesses. And if you're working with somebody that is great on hard and icy snow and sunshine, then you probably shouldn't keep working on that every single day. I mean, you need to go back to it for confidence and just to touch on it. But if you struggle in, you know, softer, fresh, you know, new snow, or you struggle in those salted conditions that we're seeing more and more nowadays. Haven't seen that much of it this year, but, you know, then that's actually the stuff that you probably need to be working on more, you know, same thing with flat light, and, you know, find a slope that's in the shade more, you know, sort of thing. And it's hard as a coach, because ultimately you're trying to make the best environment possible all the time, right? You're trying to pick the training time that's going to be the sunniest or the brightest, and, you know, have the best snow. And you spend all day after day out there making conditions perfect for the racers. And ultimately, sometimes it can be too perfect, right? Yeah. Because you get to a race and it's completely different. So, you know, I think that it's a difficult idea to really execute, but it's something that I started to do more and more in my career on the World Cup, was trying to find more challenging conditions and still mitigate risk. I mean, you have to make sure that you're not putting athletes in a position or a greater position to get hurt in a sport that's already super dangerous. So, you know, mitigating risk and still finding quality training that is, you know, slightly more challenging in a different way.
Yeah, that for sure. Do you think that the greats of ski racing, a consistent line that runs through all of them is that they were able to find like a equipment set up for every type of snow? Like, that is just something that you can't do without if you want to win consistently on the World Cup.
I don't know if it's that black and white. I mean, I think it's definitely a factor in the outcome. You know, I think the greats are great skiers. I mean, I don't know enough about Stokely, for example, and Odermatt, you know, but he seems to be pretty good in GS, Super G, and downhill. I don't know that he if he has one pair of GSKs that he uses like at Schladming Night Race that's dramatically different than everything else. But I think it's an important piece because at the very highest levels of the sport, when you're succeeding, at historic kind of levels, you need historic type of preparation, and every single detail needs to be executed at a high level. And I think that goes the same for the equipment manufacturers. I mean, it's not easy by any means. Every company has a little bit different personality with their construction, right? From Rossignol to Nordica that they have totally different personalities, and you can make adjustments to those skis and boots and bindings and everything else and tunes to make them slightly more similar or perform in a more similar way. But I think that ultimately, you start to get to a point where you have to try to do things completely out of the box with setups in hopes that you kind of hit it at some point. And it's just not as simple as changing the tune or changing the cant on the boots or something like that. Generally speaking, it has to be, a completely different construction, or, maybe a wider ski with the same side cut would be more effective in those softer kind of conditions. So you're ma you know, there's just there's a lot of different approaches to it. And I don't think that anybody in the modern era of ski racing has been great or consistently produced amazing results without an amazing setup. So, I mean, that's for sure. People have been able to overcome certain situations and still come up with great performances with maybe subpar materials. But I think when you really start to see men and women producing amazing results, it's because of a million things. But from a materials perspective, the materials have to be really spot on to produce those results.
You can't skimp out. And
No.
I talked, for anyone who hasn't listened to my interview with Ted, they should, because we talked a bit about him, his years figuring out the 35 meter ski and
I
kind of
was there
making
during
that,
that. Yeah.
and you were there during that,
Yeah.
and making that leap with the equipment, which was such a huge benefit and advantage during that time. So we don't need to go over that
Sure.
too much. But that's an example of a big step. But I think equipment has been making steps for the past 25 years, and you've been able to witness a lot of that firsthand. And with the equipment making changes, the technique makes changes as well. Has that been interesting to watch? And is there anything specific you'd say about that? Like watching the technique change in these skiers in the past?
Yeah, I don't. I actually haven't spent a lot of time thinking about this, so I sort of have to freestyle the answer. I've never been asked truthfully. I mean, I guess I look back at a time when I was racing on straighter skis, just before starting coaching. I look back at some of the skiers that I coached early on in my career that were on straighter skis. So, arcing the how dynamic the sport is and how angular the sport is now didn't exist then, right? You didn't have the side cut to support heavy edge angle or, big lateral positions, like Ted used to get into, and guys and girls are still getting into. So the evolution of the sport from an equipment perspective has been dramatic, I would say. I think that there was still a time, where athletes were stepping off the ski, right? That was the only way to finish a turn was to step off of it. And now you're not coaching that at all, or hopefully you're not coaching it. Maybe some people still are, but so I think that like any sport over this long a period of time, and just to clarify, I haven't been coaching 30 years, but I'm sneaking up on it.
Okay, sorry.
I think that the every sport that is equipment reliant and regulation reliant will evolve, you know, fairly dramatically over time, right? I mean, I think that you watch F1 cars, I mean, completely different, but the regulations that go into those cars, whether it's the tire size or construction or aerodynamic packages they're able to produce, you know, whatever it might be, DRS, like all of that stuff, I mean, they could clearly produce a car at this point that could be faster than anything in history, right? But the regulations hold them back. And I think, you know, Bodhi was always interesting about the equipment regulations. And he was a guy all along that said, I don't understand why we have any regulations. Like, you're not making us safer. Yeah. So if we want to race GS on a 15 meter radius, then we should be able to. If we want to stack our binding height up to you know, 5 inches, we should be able to. So, you know, why are you giving us regulations when it's not slowing the sport down and it's not reducing injuries? So I always thought that argument was kind of interesting. I mean, it's a simple approach to that argument, but, you know, I think overall, I mean, the ski racing has changed, you know, in a massive way since I first started coaching.
Well, I guess an argument against Bodhi's argument would be because different nations, you know, France sets a course and say France gets the world champ set for first run. If all of their guys have a pair of skis ready, that's 15 meter ski and they set really tight. You know, maybe that gives you an advantage to have a ski that you've been training on, that you have been training sets on.
I'm not sure if it was his greatest idea or well thought out idea. I'm just saying it was an idea. I mean, I think ultimately there has to be regulation. I mean, but I do think from a safety perspective, the actual skis, boots, and bindings and plates are no longer slowing athletes down. So they need to there has to be another way to figure out how to make the sport safer. I mean, Cyprian, you know, airbags are now mandatory on the World Cup tour. Clearly that didn't help him, you know, and I think that there has to be some more creative ways to slow the sport down a little bit, or at least when you're on the ground, it's a safer experience than it is. And it's always going to be a risky sport. I mean, anytime you're going, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80 miles an hour on skis, you know, wearing a helmet and a Lycra suit, I think the joke or line out there was, you know, if you want to know what crashing on in downhill feels like, just go out on the highway and jump out of your car, you know, like, so, I mean, it's going to have violent outcomes and poor outcomes, but I think that athletes have become stronger, skis, boots, and bindings have become faster. So all of the forces are greater and the speeds that they're traveling are greater. I just don't know how with the de-evolution of skis, boots, and bindings would ultimately make it safer. I feel like the lower hanging fruit would be, you know, can you make speed suits slower? Can you make, you know, FIS had some suits that had, you know, these friction points that if you fell down, you know, there on the side of your thigh, there was a really grippy kind of material that started to slow you down quite quickly. You know, those type of things, whether it's helmet technology or airbag technology or, you know, any of those type of things, the cut resistant undergarments are amazing now, but I mean, we shouldn't have any more cuts, really. Like, there's enough technology out there for oversuits and undergarments to sort of ensure that, you know, we don't have those type of injuries anymore. So, you know, I think that no, there's no doubt that the sport has become incredibly fast and the forces have become incredibly great. So that was not what I meant to say. And I think that, I just think that there's other routes to attempt to improve the safety.
Okay. I think that's a really great way to put it. Yeah. I mean, you watch Supermoto, these guys are on motorcycles going fast. They're not wearing a Lycra suit. They're wearing a leather suit and a, you know, and they still need aerodynamics, but they also need, protection. Another idea that popped into my head, and this is a debate I've had with a lot of ski friends in talking about equipment as we have been, I would argue that, a slalom skier, a top 30 slalom skier, this year would win a World Cup even 10 years ago. I think that, and there's people that would argue that the World Cup winners of 10 years ago would still be winning now on their, if you took their equipment and their performances then in this hypothetical world. What do you think?
I think it's pretty hypothetical. So I think back 10 years and I'm like, well, that was Hirscher sort of at his prime.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know about you, but like that skiing was mind blowing at the time. So I don't know if Hirscher at his prime was skiing right now in Slalom, in my brain, I would think he would be competitive, but I mean, I think in reality, the evolution of athletes and materials alone and the quality of the surface that they're producing. And honestly, the course setting has probably become easier over time instead of harder, I would say. I think with that, then, you know, modern slalom is definitely faster than it was 10 years ago.
Uh-huh. And I would say 20 years ago, it's not even a discussion.
No, because they weren't skiing on short slalom skis either, I don't think. Maybe they were.
2005. I bet they were, or maybe there was some guys on 170.
Yeah. Just starting. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But that was early in the process of
slalom ski development. Yeah. And those skis weren't great. Yeah. But no, I mean, I think that would be an easy argument that 20 years ago they were slower for sure. And I think you're right. Even at 10 years ago, I'm a huge Marcel fan. So I like to think that he would still be competitive.
That skiing when he was in his prime was just on. I mean, even whatever his prime extended to about 5 years ago, it was insane.
Yeah. Right. I mean, eight overall titles in a row. I mean, just in the acrobatics and athleticism of his slalom were just outrageous. So, I mean, it was difficult technique in general, I would say, to analyze and try to replicate because he was just so athletic. So I think that, you know, great skiing is in some cases is easier to break down and look at and think to yourself, well, maybe I'll try that a little bit, you know, but watching Marcel at the time was just like, I don't see anybody on the planet that could ski like that. So,
from a distance, being able to, I'm sure you guys trained with him sometimes, you trained next to him and obviously you were always racing with him, watching him. What are some things that you picked up on that were just, or just anything you've got for me, but stuff that was crazy or stuff that was made him different?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think he was hyper competitive. He had the same coach, Mike Parker, who's now with Broughton, for all eight of those years. He was with Mike. He had a parent that was also a tremendous coach and very involved in Ferdinand. So he had a good team around him, and his skiing was just crazy. I mean, I think his approach was interesting, especially later on, where he didn't ski a lot in the preparation period. He really pushed his prep period back almost into late summer and fall. So he was always like taking from World Cup finals off until into August, basically, middle August. And I always thought that was kind of cool because it sort of bucks the trend of, you know, everybody saying you got to ski more, ski more, ski more. So I thought that was cool. He, being the competitor he was, he hated to lose. And he especially didn't like losing to Ted. That's for sure. So, I mean, I think that, you know, there's some motivation in that as well, not just with Ted, but with anyone. But the skiing alone was just, I think his build was pretty unique. I mean, he was only like 5'7" or 5'6" and, you know, solid as a rock. So his center of mass was quite low and quite compact. And he was just able to be so acrobatic and, you know, he could be angular and efficient in, you know, I think that in a way that almost nobody has been able to do, you know. I mean, he would create massive angles when necessary, but then he was a master of efficient angles as well. Like you could see him ski on a flat at times that, you know, with a wider stance and more railroady, you know, and then all of a sudden he would break over a pitch and, you know, hip would be on the ground and have some A-frame in there.
Yeah.
Like he had so many tools in his toolbox, I guess, is the point. And I think that you know, there's a difference, and I've said it often, between style and technique, right? Every high level ski racer has great technique, right? And there's similarities in that technique. There'll always be similarities, but style, you know, when you look at a guy like Bodie, you know, he had his own individual style, and I think that's a key piece in coaching and in the sport, is to be able to identify where individual style can come out, you know, versus just focusing on technical fundamentals.
Yeah, that's a great point. The Olympic Winter Games are coming to Milano Cortina. Experience them in style with ticket-inclusive hospitality packages. Enjoy premium tickets to sought-after events, including the opening ceremony, access to lounges, and world-class service. Or turn your stay into the trip of a lifetime with overnight packages that include tickets, guaranteed accommodation, and more, so you can immerse yourself in the wonder of Italy. Book now at hospitality.milanocortina2026.org. We're nearing the end here, which is a shame because I have so much more I'd love to ask you.
You
but
can keep going. It's fine.
But there's a couple of questions that I really would like to get to. And the first one is, I read an interview online, Ski Racing Media, with you, and you mentioned the importance of preparation for races, energy management. And these two things I think are overlooked in skiing a lot. And I know that I've had coaches that have totally overlooked energy management, preparation, how motivated you'll feel after a stretch of five races and then travel or whatever it is. What have you learned in that realm, and how important is that in ski racing?
I think it's incredibly important, you know, whether it's ski racing or honestly any sport or even life for that matter, a little bit. I mean, we all get worn down and, you know, finding ways to recover and recoup and be your best self again. But with regards to sport, I think from an athlete management perspective, it's so important, and it seems super rudimentary to think that, you know, the idea of train, race, rest, right? Train, race, rest. And people, you know, the whole argument about race starts, you know, for younger kids, are we racing too much? We should limit the starts. We should limit their opportunities and force this management. You know, I don't think it should be forced, but on the same hand, I think it's incredibly important. And ski racing happens, you know, the schedule happens in a very short time frame, right? I mean, the World Cup's a little bit longer, but generally speaking, we're talking about December, January, February, March. Right. And a little bit of April. So you're talking about a 4-month season. So the stress of trying to fit a lot into that period of time is real. But on the same hand, you're not going to maximize your results or the outcome if you're constantly grinding and sort of burning the candle from both ends. So, you know, I learned more and more later in my career on that communication with athletes, and really trying to monitor the day-to-day energy levels, and that perceived rate of exertion, I think, is a great measuring tool, you know, from an athlete standpoint. Like, I don't know how you're feeling unless you actually share it with me in some sort of metric, or you get so tired and frazzled that you finally come to me and say, I'm so tired, I can't even consider skiing tomorrow.
Is the part of the problem is, like, athletes, most high level athletes have, you know, they're just like, I'm tough enough to not ever complain or whatever. I mean, not all of them, but were there any, sorry to interrupt. But this just popped into my head. Were there any, athletes you coached that were really good skiers, but they were inconsistent because they were bad at, like, energy management and race prep?
I would say that there have to have been. I can't identify anybody super specifically, nor would I want to say, like, that guy was amazing, but he couldn't race, or girl. But, you know, I think it's super critical, you know, and it's different. No offense to slalom specialists, but I mean, I think it's different managing energy when you're skiing one event versus two, or, you know, two events versus three, or in some cases, four events. I mean, suddenly that the importance of that energy management just it magnifies and multiplies so dramatically when your schedule is so heavy with competition. And competition is not just it's not just the physical fatigue, it's the mental fatigue that's equally challenging, right? You can't
100%.
get up in ready for a race into the right mind state if you're fatigued mentally. I mean, you could be peak form physically and you're just been dealing with some auxiliary type of crap on the side, and it completely takes your headspace away and you're not going to perform. So, I think that identifying those both mental and physical fatigue, and I think that it's always an easy idea to manage in a way that I mentioned, like, well, just train and then race when you're ready and then take a rest afterwards. I mean, it barely ever works out that way. But I think you have to be super thoughtful. And I mean, if you're competing at the very highest level and producing, amazing results, then clearly, there's a million different details that you have to be looking at to continuously produce, great results. And even honestly, to produce one great result, I mean, or two, it's crazy. So, I mean, I think that you can't overlook any of it, whether it's, fuel or, where, how the restaurant is, or if we have to get food from somewhere else, or, where is your room in the hotel? Is it, do you have good blinds? Like, do you need to sleep with a face, an eye mask? Like, I mean, just so many different pieces, that you wouldn't really think about, picking your training venues, in a way that efficiency is the primary piece. Like, where can you get the most runs done in 2 hours time, and privacy and everything else. So, I mean, I think that, there's just a lot of different variables to look at, but I do think that it's super important. And to with the risk level in the sport in general, and the danger in the sport, whether it's slalom or downhill, I mean, clearly, the outcomes in downhill are far worse than slalom, generally speaking, when you go down. But if you want to produce, high level results, then you have to have the preparation, and you don't have to feel your best every day. I mean, I think there's a lot of great performances that have occurred where you don't necessarily feel your best, and I think that that's also important when athletes are constantly saying, well, I'm just not feeling it, or I didn't sleep great last night. Like, you have to again be able to compartmentalize that and put it in a space where it's not noise, and still bring out your best. So, I think that there's not any perfect formula, but I think it is critical to manage fatigue.
Yeah, definitely. Completely different topic, but the other question, this is basically the second to last one. People love an underdog story, and people think it's really impressive when someone who wasn't expected to win ends up winning. But I think it's more impressive when the person who is supposed to win, quote unquote, wins. Ski racing has so many variables, like we talked about. When the press, especially at the Olympics, for example, and it's all this mainstream media saying this person is going to win, they're supposed to win. When you apply that to a sport like ski racing, it's almost laughable, but people do buy into it, like this person's supposed to win. So, for example, when you went to the 2014 Olympics with Ted, and he'd won every race that season, basically, and he was winning by massive margins, and he was quote unquote supposed to win. Like, what was that approach like? And how does Ted approach a race where everyone says you're supposed to win?
I actually didn't go to those Olympics.
Oh, really?
But no, I was done prior to that. And that's when I came to GMVS.
That's
So
right.
I heard you were available at GMVS, so I jumped on it and got to Vermont as fast as I could. I think that managing expectation is a huge piece of it, right? And the higher up the food chain, so to say, that you go, the more extreme those expectations become. But I think it's important even for junior racers, right? Like, the expectation that they feel when they go out and race, whether it's the money that their parents are spending, or that they're missing school that day, or whatever it might be. Like, to be able to manage those expectations is critical. And I think in most cases they're super unrealistic, but For me, again, I think that going back to that idea of having training and racing be as similar as they can be, right? Like if you go, you don't have those same expectations when you go out for a training day. I mean, yeah, you want a good training day, and it's a bummer when it doesn't turn out how you want it, but it doesn't feel quite as bad as it does when the race doesn't go how you want it, right? So I mean, I think the mental game, in being able to manage those expectations, but also just continuing to work towards every day as part of the process. And I'm not a huge fan of that whole process oriented, embrace the process, stick with the process. I mean, it's fine and it's what you need to do, but I mean, it's a bit cliche and it is, sort of whatever, but I do think that, if you can make your approach to most every day very, very similar, then better things will occur. And, I think that that's easier said than done. And, the higher up you go, whether it's Olympics or World Championships or World Cup or whatever it might be, it becomes harder and harder to do. And I think that's a special skill that probably every one of the greats has had, and it's probably more innate than learned. I would say, it's just something that switch was flicked, maybe from birth, and they never had to find that switch and figure out how to turn it on. So it's a challenging one to manage expectations, but I think it's always good to seek assistance from mentors or mental coaches or whatever. I don't think it's easy to go about it on your own is what I would say.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It's when I told someone today that I was going to interview you, they said ask what one of the through lines was with all the World Cup winners you've coached or seen. And that's a really cool one that I haven't heard before, is that they were all good at blocking out expectations. And the final question I've got for you, well, not the final question, but the final big question is, now that you're at GMVS, you did a stint when I was there, but you're back at GMVS, and you're coaching young athletes, which has got to be totally different from coaching people who are trying to win World Cups. What's that difference like? And like, as you see it right now, if you were telling a whole conference of coaches around the country who were trying to get their high school athletes onto the World Cup, like what's the recipe here?
Well, I couldn't share it completely, otherwise then GMVS wouldn't need me. No, I mean, I don't think there's a perfect recipe, but I do think, that it's not as different as people would imagine or suggest, and I was asked that question the first time I came from the men's team to GMVS, and was coaching you guys. And, people said, "Oh my God, it must be so different." And I was like, "Well, it's still ski racing. I mean, we're still trying to do the same things. We're working on pretty much the same things." And I think that, for me, my approach to the sport doesn't really change, with the level. Clearly the age is different. How you're going to communicate with a U8 or U10 or U12 is going to be different than a 18 or 21 or whatever. But ultimately, you're still teaching fundamental skiing and finding ways to give them the best opportunity to make good turns, turn after turn, right? So that's the same thing you're trying to do at a Europa Cup and World Cup level, Continental Cup level. So it's not as dramatic as you would think. And in coming back in this latest stint, I think that I don't feel dramatically different than I did the first time. I feel like it's still coaching ski racing. And my focus is slightly different now with GMVS. I'm trying to coach coaches, a lot, and give them the tools to succeed. And I do also very much enjoy the opportunities I get to coach athletes as well. But the fundamental bits remain the same. I mean, the same things that World Cup skiers struggle with, are generally very similar. It's just the weaknesses may be greater, and there might be more of them, or deficiencies. So I've never had a dramatic shift with that, I would say. And it honestly feels good to be back at, not grassroots by any means, but back, into youth racing and junior racing. And, I think another thing, and you probably realize this now more than ever, is that, the level to the World Cup, from where you are, or, NorAm level racers, I mean, it can seem like a quantum leap at times, but truly it's not that big a gap. Like this, the confidence level that has to come with that to try to bridge that gap is really critical, because the skiing is not necessarily that far off. It's getting the mileage and experiences, and like you said, having, getting on new hills and, being able to go back to those same slopes and compete on them a second time and a third time and a fourth time. Those type of things are huge advantages. But I think that people often think that they're so far off of the highest level of the sport, and I don't think that's always true.
I like that. That gives us hope. It gives everyone hope.
You should. I mean, I think that it's not necessarily like a lightning in a bottle kind of thing, but I mean, when one technical bit comes together in a different way, or suddenly slalom feels like it's coming at you a little bit slower, so you can actually be more offensive and push harder, and you don't really know why, but take advantage of it when it happens, sort of thing. So I think that those are the type of opportunities, and just knowing that, once you can start to resist a little more force and not rotate into the turn, or you're dropping your hand too much, and I gotta at least bring my shoulder inside shoulder forward kind of thing, like when you start to actually feel that and feel what it does to your skiing, it can come pretty quickly.
Yeah, one of the best feelings in the world is figuring something out in skiing, and suddenly you're going faster. You don't know why, but your body's doing something different. You figured something out in video or whatever, and it happens a lot more when you're younger. And I look forward to those feelings more and more now that I'm getting older. But that kind of brings us to the end here, Mike. But I always give my guests a chance to say whatever they want at the end. So you have a platform here. There's a lot of people listening. Is there anything that you'd say to people listening, or to the ski world, something to shout out, an idea to shout out, anything?
No, I mean, nothing earth-shattering again. I think that for me, I was just at Cochrane's watching a U14 race yesterday, and you've been to Cochrane's and know what the feeling is like when you pull up to that place and see the energy around, right? And I feel like, just continuing to really embrace the good parts of ski racing, like embrace the hard work, embrace the fun, embrace getting better. Like all of those types of things are critical. I think the podiums and the wins and whatever else, I mean, that's fine and it's great, but truly, love the sport. And, it's not just ski racing, but really find your passion for skiing as well. And I don't think your best results are going to come unless you really find some joy in the sport of skiing and ski racing. So find that joy and get better.
And that's coming from a man who's seen a lot of World Cup wins and podiums. So I believe it. Mike, thank you for visiting Arc City.
Absolutely. You're welcome.
I am hugely, hugely grateful for Mike to take the time to do this interview. He rushed back from the mountain the day we did it to get down to his office and get that free hour. He's crazy busy at GMVS, he says these days, trying to push the level of development at the school, which is really cool for me to see because I attended GMVS, and for a few years they were a big sponsor of mine. I deeply care about the school, and I'm really glad to see the program is in good hands. Before I go, I've got a quick skiing history nugget for you. Last episode, we talked about running fist races and all the people it involves. Many people go unthanked. but at least one has been enshrined for his work. In 2004, a man named Owen Carney was inducted into the Canadian Ski Hall of Fame, not for his skiing accomplishments, but for his 30 years of volunteer work putting on Canadian ski races. This is information taken from the Canadian Ski Hall of Fame website. He worked at the local level all the way to the international level. He was notably chief of course at the Calgary 88 Olympics, overseeing, the well-respected Olympic downhill course there, Nikiska, and he was also involved in the 2002 Salt Lake City Winter Games. And I'll read a few lines from the website, quote-unquote. His undoubted leadership qualities and ability to motivate others led to one of his greatest accomplishments, the development of a unique team of committed, skilled volunteers known as the Weasel Workers, who prepare the courses for alpine events in Canada and abroad. Over the years, led by Owen Carney, the group has grown to over 400 dedicated volunteers. To quote Doug Forseth, Senior Vice President of Operations of the Interwest Corporation, Owen is not just the leader of this group, he is the inspiration, the heart, and the soul of the Weasel Workers. End quote there. So, even if you don't make it to the Hall of Fame for your ski racing accomplishments, there are other ways to make it. Shout out to my great uncle for sending me this nugget. And that will do it for us this time here in Arc City. I appreciate all you real ones that listen to the end of all the episodes, by the way. Until next time, don't forget to buckle your boots, tighten your power straps, and synthesize ski racing. Don't make it more complicated. I'm Jimmy Krupka, and thank you for visiting Arc City.